It's Wednesday, January 16th, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. Happy New Year to both of you.
Happy Welcome New Year. Back.
We've got a lot to talk about this week. A takeover attempt. The hedge fund that owns the Denver Post is making a run at Gannett. That's the publisher of the USA Today and hundreds of other local newspapers across the country. The Bird Scooter Company, unhappy about an article online, filed a copyright complaint against the tech website Boing Boing, why it's now shifting in reverse, and scaring up subscriptions, literally. We'll talk about how a Maine newspaper got 100 new digital subscriptions in just one day. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll talk about as well before our half hour is up, but I'd like to start with the latest battle in the newspaper war between the New York Times and the Washington Post, fought this weekend, with stories connecting President Donald Trump to Russia and Vladimir Putin in new and damning ways. The story in the Times laid out the details of an FBI investigation into the president's activities and whether he was secretly working for that government, either wittingly or unwittingly. The Post followed with a piece that claimed Trump hid details of a face-to-face meeting with Vladimir Putin. Saturday night, he went on Fox News Channel to talk about a bunch of other things on Judge Jean Pirro's show.
New York Times reported that the FBI opened a counterintelligence investigation the day after you fired James Comey in May of 17. And the investigation was whether you were actively working for Russia or unwittingly. So I'm going to ask you, are you now or have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing. But the headline of that article, it's called The Failing New York Times for a reason. They've gotten me wrong for 3 years. They've actually gotten me wrong for many years before that.
So you have to give her credit. She at least asked the question. What we got in return was the most denial you're going to ever hear.
Well, I mean, she asked it, but she asked it with a chuckle in her voice, like, of course, nobody takes this seriously. And I think people are taking it seriously. And in fact, you talk about the war between the New York Times and the Washington Post. That's one I can really subscribe in. They're doing great journalism. Mm-hmm. They're checking each other's stories. They both confirmed each other's stories this past week as well. And they found some pretty interesting stuff. I mean, whether or not the FBI was biased against Trump, whether or not the facts ultimately lead to a conclusion that the president was basically, you know, beholden to Russia, just the fact that there was an investigation started is really, really interesting. And it seems like from every hint we're hearing, including from the confirmation hearings for the new attorney general, that pretty soon we're going to hear what Robert Mueller has to say. And that's when we're really going to know what facts are available.
Yeah, I think the drip that we've been talking about for 2 years now, and Robert Mueller is about to be a full open spigot. And Barr, in his confirmation hearings yesterday, pretty much laid it out that he is not going to step in the way of what Robert Mueller is doing. And that was something that was not only a concern to Democrats, mm-hmm. but it was also a concern of Republicans that somehow this was going to his confirmation hearings was going to turn into some sort of a circus. But if he came out and said, well, I have some reservations about what Mueller's going to do. Getting back to what you were talking about, Mike, which I actually agree with, what I've seen, what everyone's seen over the course of the last couple of weeks, and in terms of the coverage, is the Washington Post and the New York Times are far ahead of every other news organization in covering this White House from a fact-based perspective. And you're right in terms of they're covering each other to make sure that the information that's out there is credible. And they're giving each other the credit for it in each publication, which I think is in many ways is extraordinary.
You can argue alternate explanations for why the president has done some of the things he's done with relation to Europe. Is he in their back pocket? Is he compromised? That's one explanation. He's had, I mean, his policy toward Russia and his policies toward autocrats, I mean, all these things could have another explanation. That's just, that's the way Donald Trump is. But what about this story in the Washington Post that he is not allowing anyone in his on his rest of his team to know what he said in meetings with Vladimir Putin, whether or not that's based on being, you know, compromised or not? That's bad for American foreign policy and interests.
That story troubles me more than any of the others that have come out in the last several days, because, I mean, for a sitting president who is having these kinds of conversations with the leader of a country that we've had very rocky relationships with for going all the way back to World War II, to take the notes away from the translators and others who are sitting around to make sure that it doesn't get out, those notes belong to the United States and the United States citizens. They don't belong
to the people.
Yeah. Those notes don't belong to Donald Trump personally. So as far as I'm concerned, he's violating federal statutes by doing that.
So you bring up an interesting point, and you were talking a minute or two ago about some of the questions that had come up in the Barr confirmation hearings, and one that has a lot of journalists talking too is the question that Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota asked yesterday about the jailing of journalists and the pregnant pause followed by a big in which he would not commit one way or another to the full defense of a free press.
Well,
and maintaining the power of the Fourth Estate in that way.
I think that's a valid concern. That doesn't really distinguish him from the Attorney General of the Obama administration either. I mean, they took a lot of actions against journalists, including threats of jailing. I thought the other part of the confirmation hearing was disturbing to me is that he wouldn't give a hard and fast response, that he would make sure that whatever Mueller found, that all of the report would be released to the public in a timely fashion. He made some rumblings about, well, probably with whatever, you know, appropriate redactions or whatever need to be made, but we'll see.
Well, I mean, that bothered me as well, but you rest assured that once all of this does come out, he's, you know, Robert Mueller himself is going to be called before congressional committees, and they're going to ask for the answers regardless of what the Attorney General does.
Okay, well, so the government shutdown, I don't need to tell you or our audience that this is the longest in history, and that the stories of the regular people affected by it are becoming more and more dire. And on the whole, the American people are beyond impatient. A Washington Post ABC poll showed that a majority of Americans blame President Trump and the Republicans for the shutdown at this point. Some of the reaction that you might have had to the coverage over the course of the last three and a half, 4 weeks?
I think that, you know, the initial coverage was all policy. Mm-hmm. It was all about politics. Now you're seeing it shift. Once we hit that mark where it was pretty much assured that they were going to miss their first checks, that this was going to be the longest in history, now the stories have shifted to the people who are actually being hurt. And I think it's going to ramp up even more now that, you know, they're calling these people back into work, but they're not receiving a paycheck. I mean, that, you know, there are people out there basically saying, wait a minute, that's un-American. That's, you know, that's just not what we do. We don't have people working at jobs and not being paid. I mean, that just makes no sense. So now even that human story is going to ramp up even more.
Those human stories are totally legitimate, despite some people complaining about them. But also there's policy stories. I mean, we have problems with TSA, right, and security. We have problems with the national parks. We have potential impact on financial markets if this thing continues very long. So
those food are all safety.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Now, issuing of food stamps.
Yep.
Speaking of food, though, one silly story so far that we probably could have had less coverage on was the president serving fast food to the Clemson players because of the government shutdown. Yeah. It was humorous, nice little social meme, but did we really need to devote as much time to that as we did?
No, it
was lame. Yeah. There was an announcement on MSNBC's Morning Joe yesterday, a new analyst joining its rotation former Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. We're starting to see new patterns emerging in some of the pundits, office holders who vacated seats, either in McCaskill's case. I was going to say in McCaskill's case, having lost an election, others term limited, who are now starting to move into punditry.
I mean, I like the fact that both former Senator McCaskill and former Governor Kasich of Ohio are going to be doing this on competing networks. They're both moderates. They are probably going to provide a little bit less of the screaming and than some of the people who appear on the cable talk shows. But on the other hand, it's not all that unusual for former politicians to find themselves either being pundits or lobbyists or both. So in that sense, McCaskill's kind of following a, I wouldn't necessarily call it honorable tradition, but a tradition.
It's at least a well-trodden path.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, but I think what it does is it's these two and others I'm sure may follow shifts that conversation from being on the coast to talking about issues that really matter to people in the Midwest and in areas that don't get the kind of opinions or punditry, if you want to call it mm-hmm. that we've seen over the course of the last couple of election cycles.
Another thing that it does in both of their cases really is it keeps their names and creates a bit more of a national household name status, keeps their names out there and perhaps keeps the door open for something later on.
Possibility.
Okay, well, in what might have been the longest severance negotiation ever, or so it seemed, it's official. NBC has officially cut ties with Megyn Kelly, agreeing to pay out the remainder of the $69 million contract that the two had. And as part of it, she can go to work for another network anytime she wants. A couple of paparazzos caught up with Kelly and her husband on a New York City street. This video ran on TMZ.com.
Megan, are you any New Year's resolutions?
You know, I don't make any resolutions, but in terms of plans?
Yes, plans.
Can we see you on TV this year, maybe?
You'll definitely see me at back up.
Oh, whoa, I'm excited.
So we all remember Kelly was suspended by NBC back in October for normalizing and defending blackface as Halloween costumes and immediately put on suspension. It feels like NBC just kind of let her run away with all of this, cut their losses, ran, and didn't really stick to anything. There doesn't seem to be any real punishment in this.
Well, I mean, it's a contract negotiation. And if she didn't do anything to violate her contract, you know, NBC really didn't have a whole lot, you know, it could hang its hat on. So they're paying off the rest of her contract. They don't say she can't work for anybody else. The only thing they have reportedly, mm-hmm. again, haven't seen the contract, is a non-disparagement clause, right? So she can't say anything bad about NBC and they can't say anything bad about her. That's kind of that's good for NBC because there are lots of things she might have been privy to at NBC that could be embarrassing for them as well as for her.
Right. I mean, it's almost like we could predict this. I mean, Mike's right. I mean, she had said some inflammatory things prior to this. And I think this may have been the last straw. NBC just couldn't. They couldn't.
The Megyn Kelly experiment failed. Yeah,
they were ready to get rid of her.
They were ready to get rid of her. Yeah. It basically led to where many of us, and I think even the three of us, mm-hmm. had talked about how it was going to be difficult for them to sort of pull her into their orbit based on everything that she had done at Fox. So this was once it moved into this, it was all contractual, and NBC had no choice but to pay off her contract.
So where's she going? She's telling TMZ, I'm going to be on TV this year.
That's what I would love to know at this point. So she has this kind of, I don't want to say shady, but she has this storied past at Fox. So going back to Fox, probably not an option. NBC, well, clearly no. So there's two of the four right there, big networks.
I can't see any of the other networks.
I can't see. Go ahead.
Sinclair.
Well,
they're getting ready to launch, you know, national programming, and they've got all those stations out there. She'd probably be a really good fit for them.
And there was an article this morning on the FTV Live blog that was behind a paywall indicating that Sinclair could be a possibility, almost like the program that Cheryl Atkinson has that runs late at night there.
But that lowers her stature.
That's what I was going to say.
I mean, yeah, you're going to be on television, but who's going to be watching? You know, I mean,
it's a potentially friendly audience.
A potentially friendly audience, but also a very small local audience.
Yeah. Michelle has $30 million to help cushion the blow.
Absolutely. Well, so I guess we'll see. I'm guessing this won't be the last time that the three of us are talking about Megyn Kelly, or at least I hope not. Sunday night. The Wall Street Journal broke a pretty big story. The hedge fund that owns Digital First Media Newspapers was going to make a run at Gannett. Now, you might know Gannett better as the publisher of the USA Today, the Detroit Free Press, Indianapolis Star, Des Moines Register. I could keep going on because there are hundreds of other papers in medium and small cities across the country that Gannett owns. Well, Alden Capital, that hedge fund, has made an offer of $12 a share in cash for 7.5% ownership stake in Gannett. So when I first saw this in the Wall Street Journal, I said some pretty bad words. I will be the first to say I said some bad words, and I shared the story with a couple of people because of how much we had talked about what had gone on at the Denver Post and kind of the decimation of the editorial board as people walked away because of policies there. To think of that group coming into one of the largest newspaper chains in America, worried about what that might mean for local journalism.
I mean, first, Gannett has done plenty in recent years.
Gannett's not exactly innocent in this whole thing. There was a line in a Bloomberg piece that it was almost like the hatchet man has the axe taken to him.
Right. No,
but those are quite the same as people who, describing a couple of the pieces on our Links blog, yeah, describing Digital First. One of them was the Death Star of newspaper chains, and another called them vulture capitalists. And those are pretty good descriptions.
Well, I remember when Gannett was once called the Borg of journalism. This is one of those things that's sort of playing out because of the economy. I mean, we've talked about it and what's happening with local news and how the disruption within media has sort of created this environment in which it is difficult for local journalism to survive. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is because they were slow to the game when it came to moving to online. They relied heavily on not just circulation, but also heavily on advertising
and classified ads,
and that went in Craigslist,
yeah,
sort of eliminated that. So, I mean, you could go all the way down the line, but now you have these the venture capitalists who are basically coming in, and their whole philosophy is to basically strip it down to the studs and see what you can get out of it. And Alden is one of them. There are others out there. I mean, Gatehouse, which owns the Columbia Daily Tribune, is known for that. I mean, they're doing pretty much the same thing. So here we are with Gannett, which is one of the dominant players in local journalism, on the verge of having to go through this as well.
And whether or not this deal happens, you're going to see more consolidation. I mean, for one, Gannett is talking about buddying up with Tribune Publishing to fend off Alden Capital. You've got...
Well, and Gannett had made a play for Tribune.
Right.
Exactly.
Didn't really go anywhere.
And you've
but
got
still.
Broadcast mergers. In fact, the big one between Raycom and Gray Television was just approved here at the beginning of the year. And there's
Next
more
Star
of that coming
and Tribune
too.
Next Star and Tribune. Broadcast, yes. Mm-hmm. Broadcasting. Yeah. 7.5%. It actually doesn't sound like that much of an ownership stake. Would it give the hedge fund that much control over the company itself?
It gives them skin in the game, and then they can start dictating changes, and those changes could impact and possibly will impact local journalism in those markets.
So this year I started teaching a course to students at MU who aren't majoring in journalism to teach them more about the things we talk about on this program each week, about how journalists do their jobs, how the media operates as a business, and about fake news, what it is and what it isn't. It's a course in media literacy designed to help create solid habits while they're young. Right now there's a pretty big focus on teaching these skills in schools. Where we're not paying enough attention, it seems, is to senior citizens. There's a study out there this week that said most of the information that's been spread online and the misinformation that's being spread is being spread by senior citizens, people who are 65 and over. Some of the other variables that seem to not really have too much of an effect, income, education level, geography, that this really does end up being about young versus old, and that the older folks are the ones who are spreading the fake news.
It is concerning, and as somebody who's on the cusp of being in that codger crowd myself, it's a little worrying. But I will say, the first thing the study found was that only 8.5% of Americans in their study had shared fake news with someone. That's a pretty small percentage, and to me, that's a little bit encouraging. On the other hand, as you say, old folks are more likely to share fake news. We don't know why that is, although there's some speculation. Well, because we're not as digitally savvy as younger people, so we can be faked into sharing fake news, or we're just getting old and we're, you know, more susceptible to arguments. It might also be true that old people are just more set in their ways, and like everybody, they tend to agree with things that seem that match their own experiences and their own dispositions.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that I found fascinating about this is that, you know, and this may have something to do with the age demographic, mm-hmm. is that most of the older respondents to the survey were on Facebook, and a lot of the youngers have moved away from Facebook. They've gone on to other social media platforms. That may have a lot to do with it, where you have old, you know, that older demographic sharing fake news with others in the older demographic, and now that's sort of where all of this is sort of circulating. I found that to be very fascinating, and the fact that they actually use Facebook as one of the mechanisms that by which they were able to do some of the statistical analysis for this survey.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I was thinking about solutions, and that's the hard part,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pretty much.
And, you know, a lot of the, as you say, a lot of the focus, whether it's in literacy training or whatever, has been focused on younger people.
On youth,
people,
on the
right?
youth, yeah.
And clearly, the tactics that may or may not work for younger people are probably not likely to work for older people. Like, you download some special plug-in for your browser or some app for your phone or whatever. But what do you do? There's got to be some kind of visual cue or some sort of way to say, well, this is respected information, this is less so, but nobody's come up with a way to do it yet, and there are a lot of ideas floating around.
Yeah, there are a lot of ideas floating around. I mean, if we go back to last week when the president wanted to give his nationwide speech, mm-hmm. and the networks were thinking about doing fact-checking as he was giving it. I mean, that's one of the things that they're sort of toying with is how do you have some sort of rating system, and I think that's where you're going, or some way to rate stories as you put them out there.
Is a good point, because in watching that real-time fact-checking, I watched that with Twitter open in front of me. And again, this study looked specifically at Facebook. And one of the challenges that comes with Facebook, less so than Twitter, is the use of the algorithm. And I know that if I go through my Facebook feed today, it could still have updates showing up today from the power outages being resolved on Sunday, or about late start for school yesterday, because the algorithms continue to serve up old content as opposed to somehow phasing that out.
And by the way, can I just say one other thing? There was another study mm-hmm. recently done that shows that older people are also more likely to share fact-checked articles. And so, you know, it isn't all about us, you know, sharing, you know, bad information. Older people are also more likely to say, hey, did you see that fact check?
Right.
I'm going to share that too.
Right. Okay. Yeah. There has been no shortage of headlines about bird scooters around here, from its negotiations with the city of Columbia to the 40 confiscated units that were stolen from a university impound during the holidays. Well, the bird scooters have now made national and international headlines this week after filing a copyright takedown notice against the tech website Boing Boing after it published a story Bird didn't like. This story was basically written by Cory Doctorow, and it was basically a guide to the purchase and installation of a $30 device that took the rental scooters and removed the need to rent them, and Bird was not pleased.
No, and they sent a takedown notice basically to Cory Doctorow, who, by the way, is a famous author and a famous expert on internet and freedom of expression.
Right.
And if anybody had, if Bird had been following his writings, they'd know that probably wasn't going to sit very well with
him. And it didn't sit very well.
And it didn't. But here's the part that seemed odd to me. The takedown was based on copyright. What was their argument and how to manage that as a copyright violation?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, they have software that they've installed on these these bikes to make them so they can charge you money for them and all of that kind of stuff. But they are just as guilty by leaving these scooters all over the place, being impounded, nobody claiming them. So somebody goes to an auction and says, I'm going to buy one of those scooters for $50. There's a $30 install that will make it mine so I can ride it where. Why? What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
And besides, even if that were illegal.
Or if a scooter gets left on your private property,
and even if
why
it
even
were,
buy it?
Even if it were illegal to hack it.
It's not illegal to write about.
It's not illegal as a journalist to write about.
That was the part on the copyright that kind of got me.
That sort of shook my head and went like, okay, that's not going to fly anywhere. That's going to get dismissed. I mean, because, you know, okay, all you're doing is putting something out there that's already there. I mean, you can hit Google and it pops up and it tells you how to order it and get it. And once you buy the scooter is yours.
Even though this is kind of a funny story because Dr. O managed to put him down, there are lots and lots of these takedown requests that are being sent out to writers all the time from companies who may not have the expertise of Dr. O or the Electronic Frontier Foundation or the money to hire a lawyer to defend them.
Right. You know?
Okay, before we go, I want to talk about what I would consider to be a pretty clever marketing technique. It came on the heels of a tweet from novelist Stephen King on Friday. He was angry that his hometown newspaper was going to cut book reviews. He wrote, quote, "The Portland Press Herald Maine Sunday Telegram will no longer publish local freelance written reviews of books about Maine, set in Maine, or written by Maine authors. Retweet this if you're from Maine or even if you're not. Tell the paper, don't do this." The paper saw that as an opportunity, challenging King to get 100 of his followers to buy a digital subscription to the paper using a special promo code. And if there were 100 subscriptions purchased, they'd reinstate local book reviews. And it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about telling people what they're going to get, create a value proposition, and they're going to come back.
I think it worked for them. I mean, they...
Oh, yeah, it did. I mean, they got them. It was
twice as many.
They got twice as many as what they needed. But in order to make that work, you got to have someone like a Stephen King be the one that challenges you on it. I mean, I don't know if this could happen if you don't have that big name.
Yeah, I mean, how many smaller state publications have a celebrity of that stature?
Who reads them daily.
Who reads them.
And who calls them out publicly.
Right, right.
It was interesting because Travis McMillan, our director, as I was talking about this story, he's like, are they really getting that much? And I started thinking about how much it could be. And say people pay $5 a month. I don't know what the exact subscription rate is. But even if that means that they get $6,000 or $12,000 off of this gimmick, that is enough to freelance out.
Yes, which is what they were doing in this case.
Just a really clever sort of social media engagement effort. They use the hashtags King and Carrie, I guess, to get people to contribute money. Yeah. That's a kind of smart thinking that a lot of newspapers need to have.
Yeah, because, I mean, what they could have done was in the background just have this sort of Twitter thing going back and forth between them and not put it out there for a large audience and use it to their advantage.
And you know what it almost kind of sort of sounds like is like that whole don't boo vote. You know,
don't pick
on us for not being able to afford the local feature writing you want. Pay us to be able to go and produce that for you.
Right.
Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the talk shows tab and programs tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for composing our theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week.